Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act goes to the House for expected passage, many are lauding the bill as the most transformative and comprehensive package of reforms in generations. And it may be in terms of enhancing services for veterans, a measure Republicans opposed, and forcing corporations to pay at least some percentage of what they might otherwise pay under a progressive taxation system like we had in the 1960s and 70s. Republicans opposed that too, as did Arizona's Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who insisted on a carve-out exemption for a certain class of financial speculators and fund her campaign. And, of course, there is substantial subsidies for wind and solar power development, including the extension of the federal credits for home installation of solar generation systems. Republicans really oppose that. There is a tax incentive for people who purchase electric vehicles priced under $80,000, which is good. Of course, that doesn't really make those $75,000 electric vehicles more affordable for most of us, but maybe that will change as production scales up. Of course, it should be noted that the lithium needed for the massive batteries required by electric vehicles must still be mined, and the majority of that mining is taking place in areas that are economically deprived and where the environmental impacts of the mining are largely unregulated. There's no form of electrical generation that is completely green in that regard, but the general shift from enormously harmful fossil fuels to significantly less harmful passive and distributed generation systems is still a great leap forward. But just as increased reliance on wind and solar comes at a cost, albeit a far, far smaller one, so does the Inflation Reduction Act take a toll. Thanks to West Virginia fossil fuel advocate Joe Manchin, the bill includes provisions aimed at streamlining the environmental review process for proposed new fossil fuel extraction and conveyance projects. One such is the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which would carry natural gas across West Virginia and Virginia. People have been protesting that pipeline for years, although those protests seldom make the national news. Tree sits and blockades have been common as people protest not only the facilitation of fossil fuel consumption, but also the wide swath of temperate forests being destroyed for the pipeline's path. If you've ever seen what pipeline construction looks like, we usually see only a large pipe stretching across a virgin prairie. In a forested area, it can be like a very precise 200-foot-wide tornado cutting a groove through hundreds of miles long. Dirt roads on either side of the pipeline are cleared and margins beyond them, not to mention the excavation and grading, and it makes for a wide, messy strip of defoliation. Not only just during the construction phase, either. Property owners have land seized through eminent domain or see their property values diminished as the pipeline pushes through. There are pumping stations periodically, and those generate noise and fumes, and of course there's always the danger of a rupture or spill. Such accidents are far more common than you might think, and often those do make the national news for good reason. Manchin's insistence on restarting the pipeline construction has people in its path up in arms, so we'll try to follow their protests here. Demand for oil and natural gas will decline, as it has for coal, and the Inflation Reduction Act will help speed that along, so the pipeline may not be so profitable in time, and yet may still be halted. Another shamefully destructive fossil fuel extraction method that is ongoing in Appalachia is mountaintop removal coal mining, which we have covered here on the show many times. Briefly, that's when entire tops of mountains are literally blown up and bulldozed away to get at the thin seams of coal that could otherwise not be mined in traditional ways. The rock and dirt is pushed over the side, burying streams forever and producing toxic runoff, killing aquatic life downstream for miles. Millions of acres in West Virginia, Virginia, western Pennsylvania, and Maryland, and eastern Kentucky and Tennessee have been destroyed by this process. And of course, one of the effects is to increase flooding, such as we just saw in eastern Kentucky. If you look at areas where the flooding was worst in Kentucky, you can see via satellite images that upstream from the flooded areas, there are mountaintop removal sites. There's one not far from Whitesburg, Kentucky, where the media activist group Apple Shop had their two-story building virtually submerged. That's the home of Pacific affiliate station WMMT, which has been off the air since the floods hit. If you visit Apple Shop's website, there's a long list of links of various relief agencies helping the residents of East Kentucky survive and rebuild. We have a brief clip from an NPR news program about inland flooding as a consequence of climate change. We also have a couple of reports on mountaintop removal and the Mountain Valley Pipeline.
I remember being out in the yard and watching my grandmother float by in a canoe because her car flooded out, and she had a bag of groceries in her lap, and she waved at me, and I waved at her, and that's like I was 5 years old. I've never been able to let go of that image.
The North Fork Kentucky River crested at nearly 15 feet that year, a record that stood for more than half a century until last week. Last week's flood was more than 6 feet higher. Floodwaters actually broke the gauge.
The water came up quick. It was violent. It was rough.
Davis is the publisher of the Daily Yonder, which covers rural America. He still lives in Whitesburg. When we talked to him, he had no running water, but his house is on a hill, and he points out others were hit harder. 35 people are confirmed dead as of Monday afternoon, a number that is still expected to grow. The water washed out roads, knocked homes off their foundations. Davis says it reminded him of hurricanes he's covered.
We spent some time in the Gulf Coast after Katrina and Rita, looking at the impact of those storms. It's very similar. When the flood comes, there's no talking to it.
It feels like overnight everything's been taken away from me.
18-year-old Zachary Caudill lives in Whitesburg, too. He was on the front lines last week, helping deliver food and water to neighbors who needed it. He says it is hard to see his hometown like this.
Places where I've grown up and places where I've spent so much of my childhood at, and it's completely gone.
Climate change is making devastating scenes like these more common, and not just in Kentucky, but around the country. Davis says many parts of rural America are feeling it.
It's changing agricultural practices, it's changing the way we build, and it's changing the way we plan. And if we don't take it seriously, then we imperil ourselves.
Consider this. Climate change does not just mean a hotter world. In some places, it means a wetter one. We'll look at why catastrophic flooding is becoming more common and what communities can do to stay safe. It's Consider This from NPR. The search and rescue effort in Kentucky is ongoing. Crews are still trying to reach people cut off by washed-out bridges. For survivors, the scale of loss is coming into focus.
Where I was yesterday in Breathitt County, the homes, the water has receded, but the homes are just full of sludge and mud.
Misty Thomas is executive director of the Western Kentucky chapter of the Red Cross, which is assisting at more than a dozen shelters in the area. Sunday, she was with flood victims as they sorted through the wreckage.
They were back in their homes, and they were taking these huge squeegees and just pushing the mud out the doors, and their yards were full of the debris from the inside, their lives, everything their own outside, piled up, completely destroyed. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to watch them have to go through that.
Governor Andy Beshear has been out in the affected counties, too. He described a scene at an aid center filled with mountains of clothes.
I got to tell you, it's tough to watch people sorting through clothes, trying to find the size that fits their family members when they have absolutely nothing.
The governor also highlighted moments of kindness, of generosity. Virtually anyone in Perry County who hadn't lost a house was volunteering at shelters and aid centers, he said. Kentuckians who were impacted by an outbreak of deadly tornadoes back in December pitched in too, he told NPR.
The fire chief in Mayfield, one of the towns hit hardest by the tornadoes, got in an ambulance yesterday and drove to eastern Kentucky to help out. And the reason that he and the mayor wanted to do that was that the world was there for them in their time of need, and they wanted to be for eastern Kentucky. Pretty incredible.
Looming over the recovery, the threat of more flooding. When Beshear spoke Monday morning, rain was coming down again.
If things weren't hard enough on the people of this region, there is severe storm potential today in all of the impacted areas. That is just not right.
Destructive flooding like this has unfolded across the country this summer. Just days before the disaster in Kentucky, St. Louis got more than 8 inches of rain in 5 hours. Buddha Potosif was in his car when floodwaters overtook it.
I just heard a big whoosh and waves, and Next thing you know, I'm in 3-4 feet of water.
Meanwhile, in northern Arizona, rain in the mountains is triggering flooding in homes below. Wildfires have burned away areas of forest that would normally have absorbed some of that water. Paul Fox in Flagstaff narrowly averted disaster.
Our house almost flooded. We had a couple neighbors who actually, these guys, a handful of neighbors, grabbed some sandbags and added a couple rows.
And earlier this summer, there were those surreal scenes of flooding in and around Yellowstone National Park. NBC News aerial footage of a house sliding down a cliff face, bobbing downstream. Flooding like this used to be a once-in-a-generation type disaster, or even rarer. Speaking as the waters began to recede at Yellowstone, Park Superintendent Cam Shawley said it does not feel that way anymore.
I've heard this is a 1,000-year event, whatever that means these days. They seem to be happening more and more frequently.
Floods like these are getting more common, and a major culprit is climate change. My colleague Asma Khalid talked with Rebecca Hersher from NPR's climate team about how a warmer planet translates to more flooding and what it means for the places most at risk.
Rebecca, what is going on? You know, when I think about climate change and flooding, I mostly think about sea level rise, but that's not where all of this is happening. I mean, we're talking about cities far from any coastline.
Yeah, and you know, there are many ways that climate change can cause floods. Coastal floods get a lot of attention, especially when they happen during a hurricane. But actually, inland flooding is more common. And the kind of devastating heavy rain that we've seen this week is something that climate scientists have predicted for many decades, that as humans keep burning fossil fuels, the atmosphere gets hotter, the air holds more moisture, and so when it rains harder.
Hmm. And has that turned out to be true?
Yeah, the climate models are correct. And actually, scientists can observe it in real time now, which is pretty scary. So heavy rain has increased all over the U.S. And in the southeastern U.S., including in Kentucky, it's increased by almost a third.
Wow.
Now, that might not sound like a lot, but an extra inch of rain, if you think about it, if that falls in a short period of time, that is how you get a flash flood.
So explain that, because I do think it is shocking to see some of the damage that all of this rain has caused, particularly in Kentucky, as you mentioned.
Yeah, the danger and the damage comes from moving water, and that can happen in two ways. So first, when a lot of rain is falling in a short period of time, the water doesn't have anywhere to go. It can't soak into the ground, especially if the ground is already saturated. So that causes the water to pool on the surface. And then if there's a hill, even a really small hill, one that you might not even notice, all that water starts to roll downhill. It gathers speed, it gathers power, it can pick up debris, and that is a flash flood. It's really dangerous. It can carry away cars, it can carry away houses, and it can kill people.
So how common is that type of flooding? You know, you said it is getting more frequent at this point.
Yeah, and unfortunately, these kinds of floods, they're so frequent that they're a part of life in some places. So there are towns and cities in the U.S. where flash floods happen every year or every other year. That's true in parts of Southeast Texas and Louisiana, parts of the Midwest and Appalachia where this week's floods happened. For example, last summer, there was a flash flood that killed nearly 24 people in Tennessee. That same area was hit by very heavy rain this year. And it's important to say this is not just a U.S. problem. It's happening outside the U.S. as well. So heavy rain has caused deadly flash floods in Germany and Belgium, South Africa, India, China, and Australia, and that's just in the last year.
So what can be done to warn people when a flood is about to happen?
Well, that's actually something the National Weather Service is really focused on. So local offices are watching for signs of heavy rain and then trying to warn people as early as possible if a flash flood is likely. And that's really important because so many of us get our weather warnings now directly on our phones, right? Your phone will flash and you'll get an alert saying there's a flash flood warning for your area. And if that happens, you need to take it extremely seriously. And particularly, don't drive on flooded roads. It's one of the main ways that people die in flash floods. Their cars just get swept away.
So, I mean, I've got to wonder, are there ways to make these floods less dangerous, or do we all sort of have to learn to live with this new reality?
There are lots of ways to make them less dangerous. So basically, you slow the water down, give it safe places to go. For example, have less pavement so the water can soak into the ground. You can build retention ponds, you know, those low marshy areas for excess water to collect.
Right.
And in cities, you can make the pipes bigger. So a lot of U.S. cities were built 50, even 100 years ago. The stormwater systems are not built for the heavy rain of today. It's expensive to make those pipes larger, but it's really important if you want to prevent streets from turning into rivers.
Rebecca Hersher from NPR's climate team, talking with NPR's Asma Khalid.
What that report failed to mention, of course, are the human or anthropogenic contributors to flooding. These include the destruction of coastal wetlands, such as we saw in the New Orleans area when Hurricane Katrina struck. Wetlands areas that acted as a buffer against storm surges have been filled in to make room for housing developments. Inland, you have urban sprawl, of course, but even in rural areas, some small towns are still at risk when housing developments are built upstream. I was at a music festival in Cumberland, Maryland, one year when a freak storm blew through, briefly drenching the festival grounds. But later that day, my neighbor at the festival, a hat seller from Ellicottville, Maryland, had to pack up and leave urgently as he had gotten word that his house and workplace were underwater after a flash flood had swept through his little town. Sure enough, if you look at the aerial map of Ellicottville, you can see that a massive housing development had gone in just upstream. Where there had been forests, there were now lawns and cul-de-sacs. Where there had been streams and bogs, there were now roads and driveways. Similarly, if you look at an aerial map of eastern Kentucky, it might be a little harder to see, but mountaintop removal has forever transformed the landscape there, leaving flat, treeless mesas where once were mountain peaks. Many of the old mountaintop removal sites appear green from the air due to opportunistic grasses and small woody plants, but that kind of bioculture offers little in the way of absorption. Flash floods are not completely uncommon in mountain valleys and waterways, but the combination of more intense storms, heavier rains, plus the wholesale degradation of the mountain landscape makes floods like the one in eastern Kentucky both more frequent and more severe. Up next, we have reports on both mountaintop removal and the Mountain Valley Pipeline.
A deal from top Democrats could pave the way for the completion of a controversial gas pipeline that cuts through Virginia. Capitol Bureau reporter Jackie DeFusco is digging into the agreement.
Well, Senator Joe Manchin reached a surprise agreement with top congressional Democrats and the White House to secure his swing vote on funding to fight climate change as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. Now we're learning that a part of that agreement was to pass legislation to remove barriers to the Mountain Valley Pipeline. These protesters sitting in now taken down trees for more than 900 days, among the many trying to stop the Mountain Valley Pipeline from coming into service. But a deal struck by top Democrats could lend a hand to the stalled project, a concern for groups like Appalachian Voices, citing hundreds of environmental protection violations.
We see it's really a water disaster in the present. It would be a climate disaster in the future to have a pipe of that magnitude.
With the Senate's top Democrat now urging fellow lawmakers to fall in line, Senator Tim Kaine has not made up his mind.
There is no connection between voting on the Inflation Reduction Act and then having to vote for the Mountain Valley Pipeline or a permitting bill. No one's made commitments about how they're going to vote, and I'm certainly not going to make a commitment until I see what that bill is.
But Kaine saying the federal process for approving pipeline projects is broken, and he's open to working on reform. Meantime, public comment on the Mountain Valley Pipeline's request to extend its permit for 4 years just wrapping up. The request opposed by more than two dozen Democratic state lawmakers, but supported by Governor Glenn Youngkin. Youngkin writing in a letter, quote, "If the project permit is allowed to expire prior to its completion, the ability of Virginia's natural gas and electricity utilities to keep energy prices low and secure a reliable supply of energy would be jeopardized."
Now, this project was originally set to go live back in 2018, and despite ongoing efforts to stop it, a project partner for the pipeline telling me in a statement that they now expect to start service in the second half of 2023. Reporting in Richmond, I'm Jackie DeFusco.
We've lived here 47 years, and it means everything to us. My kids come home, and we don't have $1 million home like I told you earlier, but we got $1 million memories, more than $1 million memories. This pipeline is supposed to come down this hill and right across 42 here, right over in my flock's bed. The center of the pipeline is 62 feet from my kitchen window.
How does that make y'all feel?
Devastated. Nothing is that is man-made is perfect. And I would always be afraid, my children out there, because that's where they play. They hide Easter eggs, and they all go out there and make pictures. And I would always be afraid what would happen if that pipeline exploded in them there.
So, you know, just a quick summary, the EQT Corporation wants to build this pipeline to get their fracked natural gas from their fields about 303 miles from West Virginia through Virginia. It's a 42-inch pipeline. Nothing this size has ever come through here. It would be an ugly swath full of erosion. And instead of seeing mountains, trees, beautiful vistas, we would see a permanent scar and a permanent danger. And they would take this, contaminate their water, and pretend that this is for their good. And the reality is there is no economic benefit for us. It's all cost. Lost property tax values, lost tourist revenues. For the counties that it goes through here in Virginia, a total of approximately $8 billion over the life of the pipeline would be lost. Not to mention what you can't put a price on, peace of mind. This is making people sick. It's basically taking a pristine area, one of the most beautiful sections of the Appalachian Trail, in our opinion, and turning it into a permanent industrial site, which would have underneath it buried poison under pressure, which, if it failed, is capable of starting a huge forest fire and contaminating the water on both sides of Peters Mountain.
A lot of people don't understand that the Appalachian Trail is a unit of the National Park System and preserved just like Yellowstone or Yosemite or something like that. And I think that if a company was proposing to put a 42-inch pipeline across Yellowstone, they would be required to have an accurate map of Yellowstone and to really approach that pretty thoughtfully. That's not the case. That's not what happened here. The information has come out in such a confusing and bewildering way. People don't have access to it. I mean, when you think about the 20,000 pages that have come out since the close of the comment period, it makes me think, like, is this the company that we want constructing a pipeline, carrying an explosive liquid under people's homes and things? You know, we want somebody who's pretty thorough doing that stuff. And I just think if you didn't even bother to get the right map of the Appalachian Trail or understand what federally designated wilderness was before you drew a line on a map, what does that mean for the construction and maintenance of the pipeline?
So the amazing thing about this pipeline is that it's been able to unite people who cannot agree on anything else. In Craig County, which we're very close to right now, they had their Board of Supervisors election last fall. And the two new members of the Board of Supervisors are Tea Party Republicans, and they each had two signs in their yard. One sign was Trump and Pence, and the other sign was No Pipeline. So, in essence, this company has been able to unite the Tea Party with the greenest environmentalists, the most left-wing Democrats. And it's really easy to understand, after all. Because here we have a private company that wants to use the federal power of eminent domain to take away people's private property to build a pipeline that we don't even need.
The Adley Jones family farmlands consist of about 700 acres back in the early 1900s. The pipelines could be laid 300 to 400 foot of my great-grandfather's house. It means a lot to me. You know, when I was a little guy, I'd come up here and stay with my granny and just run all over these mountains. You know, we didn't have to work it as kids. We did help them in the gardens and stuff some, but we didn't have to physically work it like they had to. So that's why it's so meaningful for my dad. He had to work these lands. The pipeline's slated to come through right there in that clearing. They're going to come in here and cut 125 foot of all our old growth trees out. I mean, it's going to be a nasty scar, and all that runoff water has nowhere to go but in sinkholes, and who knows where else in people's wells. So we try to educate the surveyors. I tell them straight up, first thing I tell them is, all right, people, y'all are legal trespassers. We don't want you on our property. You're more than welcome to come and ask me to come onto the property, and I'd love to show it to you, but not like this. You know, if this pipeline comes through, if they can start taking our property, then they can take yours.
And not for the common good.
for whatever a private business interest is, as long as they have enough money to buy it.
We need to start looking at our water. We have dirty water everywhere. We have pure, clean water up here. Why are we going to let this company risk taking that away? You can't buy that. You cannot buy it. I hope we can rally some people. It takes a movement of people to understand what is happening to us and what can happen to them. People have to get involved, make their governors know, say, hey, this isn't right.
Write letters to everybody that can read. Write letters in support of us, because I would try to do that for them. And don't forget to pray and thank God for everything that He does do.
At this point, I think the most powerful things that we can do is to let our elected officials know at the state and national levels that this is not healthy for us, it's not necessary, and there are better solutions. I think our legislators and our courts, when they understand the full problems here, can help us. And they'll only do it if they hear from us as citizens of the United States. My hope is it stays just how it is right now. This sound, these sights, these people on their land. And we will do everything to stop it.
Building a pipeline to this region is a gamble. It's not only because of the potential impact on our water, but others as well. And this whole area is heavily karst. Giles County has more karst than any other county in Virginia. It could lead to instability because the surface on which the pipe is resting could collapse. It collapses on its own without any work. We have places where the sinkholes are just almost on top of one another. And once they get into this, it'll be like a landmine. They're going to come through here and build 10 by 10 foot trenches. They're going to disturb the terrain. It's going to almost for sure result in changes in the water flows, which will affect our access to drinking water. On top of all that, Giles County is a seismic zone. It's an active seismic zone. It's the center of the largest earthquake in this part of Virginia, and there are constant small tremors. So we're not just worried about the big one, which would clearly cause a threat to this. We're worried about those slopes with the slip soils on them, and then these moderate tremors on top of it. And like, what a stupid place to build a pipeline.
All of the geology here is what they term karst. What that means is the land is full of caves and sinkholes and hidden rivers and hidden streams. And they meander around underground. We don't know where they come out. Anything that we do to damage the water supplies here, It could contaminate for miles and miles and miles. It could actually go all the way to the Atlantic Ocean and to the Gulf of Mexico.
In 1941, my dad witnessed a sinkhole right up here on the ridge, about 100 foot from where the pipes would be laid. And this is like a 350-acre watershed. The water runs off this mountain with nowhere to go. It sinks into a sinkhole, which feeds sinking creek. And so when they clear cut this, there's going to be an excessive amount of runoff. And all that sediment and all is going to be contaminating Sinking Creek and who knows where else in people's wells. But if this thing were to rupture, the earth shift, and we're in a seismic zone, crack this pipe, leak this high-pressure gas into these caves, and it has no odor. It's not like the gas in your house where they add an odor to it. This has no odor, so you don't know that it's leaking. And if it leaks in a cave and you have to have static in your sweater, and you might be a mile or two from the pipe, I mean, you could just blow the whole side of the mountain up.
All the water here is connected in ways that really aren't mapped. And yet the pipeline, a huge pipeline, 42 inches in diameter, buried in the ground, leaking, it will leak, there's no question, perhaps exploding, would be seeping water so that water that people are using in their wells miles away could be contaminated by the pipeline. So an important thing to remember about the geology here and the risk factors is that it's not just one thing. It's several things that are all happening together at the same time and in the same place. First of all, you have steep slopes. Slopes of 30, 40, 50, 60, 70%. That means that there's a landslide-prone situation. Then you have poor rocky soils. That magnifies the problem. Then you have karst near the bottoms of these areas and in some areas on top. Limestone with sinkholes that could collapse. They're on that mountain. That's not all. You're in the middle of the Giles seismic zone, scene of the largest earthquake in Virginia history. It had an earthquake last year. So you have steep slopes, karst, landslide-prone soils, the pipeline company themselves admitted, and it's in the middle of an earthquake zone. What could possibly go wrong? Company on this project is EQT from Pittsburgh. They are not a pipeline company. They've never done a project like this. They're a fracking company. They drill for oil and gas. They are losing so much money. Last year they lost net almost $500 million. They have what we call a stranded asset. They have way too much natural gas and they are desperate to sell it somewhere. They want to use us as their pipeline colony. We learned that one of the main partners has a contract to send natural gas to India. We also learned that one of the main partners is Consolidated Edison. That's a utility in New York State. New York State has outlawed fracking, and they have stopped two pipelines by denying them permits for water because they understand in New York State that these pipelines are a threat to the public water supply. But now, if you come down to this part of Virginia, we can be a third world country where New York can get their natural gas by coming through our homes and communities and our part of the Appalachian Trail, and we don't appreciate it.
Our economic resources are natural, and there are many. And a major source of income for this county is our natural outdoor recreational activities. We get $26 million a year in sales tax from the outdoor recreational activities here. This is a poor county. That $26 million is a heck of a lot of money. We long ago made our stake in taking advantage of our natural outdoor recreational activities. We don't want this place turned into a pipeline alley. We don't want it trashed. It'll totally destroy everything we built. This pipeline is the wrong investment. If you care about jobs, you care about development, you care about the future of the United States, I don't know what to say. We're not going to go along with it. We're not going to stand for it. We're going to resist this in whatever nonviolent way it takes.
And the reality is there is no economic benefit for us. It's all cost. Lost property tax values, lost tourist revenues. For the counties that it goes through here in Virginia, a total of approximately $8 billion over the life of the pipeline
would be lost. This is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is an American citizen, landowner, concerned about my air and water issue. Let's have a rational policy. What's going on right now is helter-skelter. Company A has too much natural gas, so they can build a new pipeline. Company B does too. Let's let them build a new pipeline. Let's have a rational policy. We have very good existing studies from the Department of Energy and from private firms showing that these pipelines are not needed at all, these particular ones, but that there are solutions for getting that gas to market that don't involve taking people's private property and tearing up the mountains and creating all these hazards to our water and our safety.
And I work for the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. My friends over at the Trek saw a conversation I was having on their Instagram page with a dude named Sawdust in My Coffee about Mountain Valley Pipeline. And Sawdust had some good questions, reasonable questions, about why we are opposed to Mountain Valley Pipeline when there are pipelines all over the place. So I'll give you two ways we think Mountain Valley Pipeline is inferior to the existing industry standard. First is they didn't have an accurate map of the Appalachian Trail when they did their alternatives analysis process and when they put the project out for public comment. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. First is that there are existing energy corridors on that same mountain, existing pipeline corridors, and we feel like would have more highly valued co-locating their project with existing projects if they had an accurate map of the Appalachian Trail. We try to advocate for co-locating similar projects to reduce impacts. And like I said, an existing pipeline corridor should be a great opportunity to do so. I think if they had an accurate map of the Appalachian Trail, that possibility would have ranked a lot higher. Secondly, they didn't do a visual impact analysis until after the close of the public comment period because they didn't have an accurate map of the Appalachian Trail to do it with. So they couldn't provide information to the public and allow the public to weigh, you know, their perceived need for energy infrastructure against possible impacts to their favorite recreation resource. That's how it should work, and it didn't happen. So that's one way they didn't have an accurate map of the Appalachian Trail. Second, for the Forest Service to allow this project to move forward, they would have to fundamentally change the way that Appalachian Trail is protected on all national forests. And actually, it's the same way a lot of other national scenic trails are protected on other national forests. It's called the Appalachian Trail Prescription Area, and in that prescription area, there are what's called scenic integrity objectives. Now, I know that's a little bit of jargon, but it's important to know because if you wanted to negatively impact a national scenic trail, changing the scenic integrity objectives is a good way to do that. To allow Mountain Valley Pipeline to go through Jefferson National Forest, they would have to lower the scenic integrity objectives in certain places from high to below moderate, and that's not a good thing. So, you know, those are two ways we feel like Mountain Valley Pipeline is inferior to the industry standard and some of the reasons why we're opposed. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some information, and cheers, guys. That's good.
Appalachia,
a landscape of tremendous beauty and biodiversity, with a rich natural and cultural heritage, is being plundered by the coal industry. Across the coal fields of West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia, operators of surface mines are leveling mountains, polluting water, destroying future possibilities for nature and people, helping cook the planet, and turning North America's most ancient mountains into an undeclared national sacrifice zone in search of maximum profit and so-called cheap power. Mountaintop removal is strip mining on steroids, a radically destructive form of surface mining that leaves a wake of destruction, from extraction to combustion to waste disposal. Burning coal from sheared-off mountains is anything but cheap. The costs to the landscape, to wildlife, to healthy waterways and human communities are incalculable, and growing with every mountain slated for execution. First, the forest is scraped away, sometimes clear-cut, sometimes the trees are bulldozed into a pile and burned. A pad is cleared, and drilling rigs bore a series of holes that are filled with explosives. The resulting blast may rattle houses, disturb wildlife, and spray a large area with dust and flying rock. A mere handful of workers using giant machines decapitate the mountain piece by piece. The resulting rubble, what the coal industry calls overburden, is pushed into adjacent valleys, creating massive valley fills, which destroy the ecologically crucial headwater streams that had been there before. Some 2,000 miles of Appalachian streams have already been filled or severely degraded by mountaintop removal mining. The unprocessed coal is transported to a prep plant, where a toxic soup of chemicals is used to remove impurities from the raw coal before it's sold. Prep plants, which also process coal from underground mines, produce vast quantities of liquid waste called coal sludge or slurry. Coal slurry waste is commonly injected into abandoned underground mines, which can lead to groundwater contamination. But most often, it's stored in unlined lagoons or surface impoundments created near mountaintop removal mines. Hundreds of these slurry impoundments are scattered across the coal fields. Some individual impoundments are permitted to store billions of gallons of coal sludge waste. The riches generated by mining, like the coal, are mostly exported outside the region. There is a remarkable correlation between the coal field areas most affected by surface mining and high poverty rates. When the coal is burned, it spews mercury and other heavy metals into the atmosphere. Coal-burning power plants, many of them old and without adequate pollution controls, are the nation's major source of industrial air pollution, and are estimated to cause 24,000 premature, avoidable deaths and tens of thousands of non-fatal heart attacks among U.S. citizens every year. Coal-burning power plants are also the single largest source of America's global warming pollution. And after the carbon-rich rock is burned, mountains of ash remain. Coal combustion waste typically contains arsenic, mercury, chromium, cadmium, and various other pollutants, but its disposal is unregulated under federal law. The massive coal ash spill into Tennessee's Emory River in December 2008 was yet another reminder that burning coal is a toxic process from cradle to grave. A mountaintop removal mine may be the ultimate symbol of our failed energy economy, one that allows natural capital, in this case, the most diverse forest in North America, to be liquidated by corporations for short-term profit. The practical effects of surface coal mining on the ecosystems and human communities of Appalachia are anything but symbolic. Flooding, narrow mountain roads filled with overloaded coal trucks, coal dust from blasting and prep operations, polluted waterways and dying communities. These are everyday realities for people living throughout the Appalachian coal fields. It would be a mistake, however, to think that mountaintop removal mining is just a regional issue. We are a wasteful society, using twice as much electricity per person as some countries with a comparable standard of living. Surface mined coal from Appalachia powers just a tiny percentage of U.S. electrical production, an amount easily eliminated from the energy mix by conservation. But roughly half of total U.S. electricity still comes from burning coal. Millions of Americans are affected by air and water pollution from coal-burning power plants, and every American, indeed every living thing on Earth, has a stake in the effort to stop global warming by leaving coal, the dirtiest of all fossil fuels, in the ground, and transitioning to a sustainable energy economy based on renewables. Ultimately, there will be a future beyond coal, for the planet, for the landscape of Appalachia, and for the region's proud citizens who are fighting to end mountaintop removal. Across Appalachia, a grassroots movement led by ordinary people is pushing back against the forces destroying their beloved mountains. These activists are countering the dirty lie that coal burning can be made clean, and challenging every American to open their eyes to the plunder of Appalachia, to witness the destruction and ask themselves, is this necessary? Is this desirable? Is this the legacy, blown up mountains and polluted waters, that we wish to leave to future generations? Citizens from around the country are joining the effort to protect the beautiful curves and folds of these ancient mountains and create vibrant, healthy communities in a landscape that for too long has been treated as a resource colony by distant corporations. The needed economic transition must steer away from corporate profit toward sustainable, durable economies that respect local traditions and are environmentally sound. The challenge before us as a nation is to act quickly, to move toward a post-coal future before more mountains are turned into moonscapes. With roughly 500 mountains sacrificed already, how much longer will Americans allow this outrage, the plundering of Appalachia, to continue?
I think coal companies do owe it to the communities to restore the land as best as possibly can be done.
What we don't know is what the companies are actually doing at this moment. Almost impossible to legally see from the ground. So if we can see it from satellite images, we can get some idea of what's actually happening on the ground. We've been mining coal in this region for well over 100 years. So it's not just the coal mining that's problematic, it is the method and the impacts that method has. Mountaintop removal coal mining is used pretty much exclusively in central Appalachia. The process involves using explosives and machinery to remove the tops of mountains to expose the coal seams below. Mountaintop removal tends to create a lot of waste material. There's a lot of excess rock, excess dirt, and then the company needs to do something with that material. So a lot of the time that material is used to regrade and reclaim the mine, but there's usually excess. So a lot of the times it's pushed over into the valley below and buries a lot of headwater streams and damages downstream water quality.
So basically we come out here and try to get as close to their monitoring sites as we legally can, and then we duplicate the tests to see if their results are accurate, to see if we find other problems for things that they may not be required to monitor for.
There's a lot of emerging science about the damage that may cause to humans. It can be expensive for coal companies to fix those problems. And if they can hide the fact that they're avoiding some of those requirements, then they don't get caught. Appalachian Voices works with community members to find those additional problems that may be missed or may be covered up by the company. In the early days of Appalachian Voices, one of the things we helped bring to the toolbox was doing flyovers. So literally getting in small airplanes, taking cameras, and taking photos and video of the mines as we flew over them. But they're hard to do, they're expensive, and they're time consuming. So the next thing we did was figure out how to start looking at the mines using satellite images from Google Earth.
SkyTruth is an environmental nonprofit, and we focus on using satellite imagery and digital technology to raise awareness about the impact that human activity has on the environment. And so we're looking at how each color represents a different year of active mining, so then we transition across the landscape. SkyTruth's first forays into mapping surface mining in Appalachia date back to 2009 when we were approached by Appalachian Voices. We worked with them to put together the first map of where these mines were located. Our original work was limited by the fact that we had to sift through imagery and find suitable scenes. And what we ended up doing was selecting one usable scene for each year that we were trying to classify mining. Earth Engine and satellite imagery is really allowing researchers to conduct studies that were previously impossible. Now, once we know where mining activity is taking place, we can use that information to track that site through time.
Using Google Earth, we came up with a figure of about 500 mountains being destroyed by mountaintop removal mining, and at the same time found that 1.5 million acres have been surface mined in central Appalachia since the 70s. Another thing we were able to show is that over 2,000 miles of streams have been buried through surface mining in central Appalachia.
We do a lot of water testing because that water, it has to leave the mine eventually. Water flows downhill. So figuring out where those paths would be and where they would intersect, like a public road or a public waterway, Google Earth is really helpful for us in doing that.
We have caught companies in the past that fabricate their data. In 2010, Appalachian Voices discovered that several large mountaintop removal companies in Kentucky were falsifying their compliance records for the Clean Water Act. Basically, they were fabricating the data for their wastewater. We were able to file several lawsuits that basically forced those companies to clean up their act. We helped to create additional tools to better safeguard against falsification of water monitoring data.
Mining continues, but our historic work has illustrated that good access to data can help make environmental policy changes which may limit the extent of mining. So we're using this data to track the progress of reclamation in formerly mined sites. Reclamation can take a variety of forms, but essentially what a lot of it is removing of haul roads, regrading landscapes, and then revegetating the landscape.
A lot of cases, it's returned to, you know, forest or grazing land for cattle. And it can go all the way up to shopping centers or schools and hospitals or kind of industrial use.
Mine reclamation for a surface mine in this area usually consists of basically trying to put the mountain back, replanting trees, and making sure that water leaving the mine is clean and safe to enter into streams below.
That runoff from a mine, it will eventually reach some local river that gets used by local people. So I drive around and I look for public roads that go below mines and up valleys that receive the wastewater runoff. I use the Google Earth app on my phone a lot when I am trying to ground truth a mine. Not only can I figure out where I'm going, but I can do measurements on the fly. So we could get a sense of how big this slurry pond we were driving past is.
Coal companies are hiding what they're doing. It was common practice, especially at the height of surface mining, to leave a strip of trees between the surface mine and the road so that people on the public road couldn't see the mine.
This is the title track off of my new album. This is called When the Light Shines Again.
1895, coal mine shut down and began the downfall of their little hometown. Well, the miners walked out busted and broke while the jobs headed west to Colorado.
My papaw was an underground coal miner for over 30 years. It offered him a way to make a living, and without that, my family wouldn't be here in this town. So he spoke about the environmental effects, how even at times when he was unemployed, he never believed in going to work for a strip mining or a mountaintop removal company because he didn't believe that the amount of coal or the amount of money that might be made was worth the environmental damage that could come from that type of mining.
Lugs and belt buckles don't mean much these days.
My papaw, unfortunately, like so many coal miners in the region, has suffered some negative health effects from working in the mining industry, and today he suffers from black lung disease. I don't think he begrudges working in the mines, though. He enjoyed it. You know, we want the same things as everybody else in any community wants. We just want a safe, healthy place to live where people can work and raise families and go to school and live a successful life.
Turn down your lamps, it looks like the end.
I really want to put together this album as a way to kind of cut through all the noise and sound bites that are being created about the region and about coal mining to say, here is a real explanation and a real look at what it's like to live in a coal mining region in Southwest Virginia.
So we're looking at whether there's tree survival, whether the trees look healthy. We're looking at what type of trees there are. Sometimes you can tell that by drone, like in this case, but a lot of times we would need to request an inspection and be able to go on site.
You know, I think one of the utilities of this tool and this data set that we're creating is it will allow researchers to examine how effective different reclamation efforts are. And so we can highlight operators who are doing things the right way, or, you know, drawing attention to those areas where the company's failed its reclamation effort. It hasn't achieved the benchmark that it should be reaching or that it says it has reached. So we're not just using it to ID where mines are, we're also looking at how forests recover on these sites. And that's all done via Earth Engine.
Roughly a decade ago, we did use Google Earth to look at the fate of reclaimed mines. We called it reclamation fail.
Reclamation fail is a pithy term we came up for when the mining company loses incentive to follow through with its reclamation plan. It is cheaper for the mining company to pay the fine than to do the reclamation. That's a kind of the worst example of reclamation fail.
We are at the top of Black Mountain, which is right on the Virginia and Kentucky line. Black Mountain is the highest point in Kentucky. We are looking at the Looney Ridge surface mine that's on the Virginia side. So we're looking at a big mine that needs a lot of reclamation. This mine has essentially been idled for about 7 years, maybe a little bit longer even. So the concern about this particular mine is that it has been idled so long that if the company were to go bankrupt, reclamation becomes less certain.
And it will leave the mine in a state of being unreclaimed, and it'll really be the kind of the ward of the state or the federal government to clean it up, and that's kind of the worst case scenario.
These communities are historically underserved. Operators are legally required to restore the landscape to some sort of higher use. And if there's no real way to measure how effective reclamation efforts are, we might be continuing to neglect these communities.
This region absolutely deserves proper reclamation because these communities have worked in these mines for generations, and they have produced the coal that has provided a huge percentage of the energy that this country has been built upon.
I, like many people in our community, believe that coal companies should repair the land because we've given them a lot, and I think the least that any company can do is help us repair the damage that's been done so that as we move forward in the region, whether we continue mining coal or not, we will have a healthy environment to exist in.
You just heard several reports from various sources on both the Mountain Valley Pipeline and mountaintop removal generally. We'll follow all of those issues here on Conscious Voices in coming editions. You can hear them here on your community radio stations at this time on WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM and WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you next week for another edition. Take care.